From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Thousands and thousands of folk in detention right now since September 11th, just like Mumia Abu-Jamal in detention for almost 17 years. Targeted by the repressive apparatus of the U.S. nation state. Vicious repressive apparatus. In the name of security for some.
We look at the war at home as the war abroad continues with a string of mistakes across southern Afghanistan from the U.S. air war that smashed the Taliban. We'll return to the critical voice of activist, theologian, and scholar Cornel West. He has his own battle to fight now at Harvard University, where he's professor of African American Studies and Philosophy of Religion, up against the president of Harvard, former Treasury Secretary and IMF official Larry Summers. And 1 month after Bush accuses North Korea of being part of an axis of evil, protests erupt in South Korea over his current visit. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! Breaking the sound barrier, I'm Amy Goodman. A federal appeals court handed a huge victory to the nation's largest television networks and cable operators, ruling the government has to reconsider sharp limits on the number of stations a network can own, striking down the regulation that had restricted cable operators from owning television stations. Unless overturned on appeal, the ruling would remove significant impediments that have prevented companies like AOL Time Warner from merging with broadcast networks that own TV stations. It would also permit big broadcast networks like Viacom, CBS, and the news corporation's Fox, which have bumped against the station ownership limits, to continue buying stations unimpeded. The decision is seen as a setback by smaller owners of broadcast stations and consumer groups advocating more diversity in media ownership. The ruling could open the door for a new wave of mega mergers in the entertainment and media industries and a continued concentration of power among the biggest media companies. Big media corporations praised the ruling. Meanwhile, the Media Access Project, a group that advocates diversity of the airwaves, said his group will appeal the decision, taking it to the Supreme Court if necessary. In a first victory for Slobodan Milosevic, the judges at the UN War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague excluded testimony from the prosecution's senior investigator, saying it's based on inadmissible hearsay. Kevin Curtis, the prosecution's chief war crimes investigator for Kosovo, was due to testify about alleged killing sites from the 1999 Kosovo War. But the judges ruled his testimony would be irrelevant since he was repeating stories he had heard from others. Milosevic chided the prosecution for preparing what he said were hundreds more such statements. Milosevic is the first former head of state to be charged with war crimes while in office. He could be sentenced to life imprisonment if convicted on any one of 66 counts of genocide and crimes against humanity. Israeli warplanes and helicopters continue to pound areas in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. In some of the heaviest attacks by Israel in nearly 2 years, 15 Palestinians were killed by Israeli forces today, while warplanes and helicopter gunships attacked Yasser Arafat's seaside compound in Gaza City, as well as his headquarters in the West Bank town of Ramallah. Meanwhile, yesterday, 8 Palestinians, including a 14-year-old girl, were killed as Israel launched attacks throughout the occupied territories. In one strike, Israeli helicopter gunships fired 3 missiles in the crowded Jabalia refugee camp, killing several Palestinians and wounding scores of others. We go now to Gaza City, where we're joined by Barbara Lubin, the executive director of the Middle East Children's Alliance. She was in the Jabalia refugee camp as Israeli helicopter gunships launch missiles at the camp. Barbara Lubin, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks, Amy. How are you?
It's very good to have you with us. If you could speak as loud as possible, can you describe?
I will speak loud. Yeah.
Can you describe what happened yesterday and speak louder even than you are right now?
Well, I was visiting a project of the Middle East Children's Alliance in Jabalia refugee camp yesterday, a children's library. And when I came out, suddenly an Apache helicopter just swooped down and sent three missiles into the house five doors away from our children's library. And Amy, you know, Jabalia refugee camp has over 80,000 people living in 1.5 square kilometers. It is one of the most densely populated places on earth. And these missiles came at a time when children were leaving school. They had split shifts, so children were coming home and children were going off to school.
Can you keep going with your description?
Sure. I decided that I wanted to go in and see exactly what happened. And although there were thousands of people that just appeared out of nowhere in the street, I was taken into the house right after the missile struck. And what I saw there was just horrifying. There was total destruction. And, of course, the two young men were dead, and one of their heads was split in half. Upstairs was a family that lived in the apartment. The little girl, who's 8 years old, had just come home from school. She had her school clothes on, and they were hurt very badly. And the little girl, I followed her to the hospital, and she's now in intensive care because she has shrapnel in her brain, and they're not sure what's going to happen. Seven other kids were injured really horribly, and several adults. So, you know, and I heard yesterday some American news people saying two killed in Jabalia, four injured. And, you know, what does that mean? Two killed, four injured. Who are these people? The two that were assassinated, they weren't killed, they were assassinated. They were students at the Islamic University. They were members of Hamas. They were not part of the military wing. And they just happened to be in that place at that time. And the children and the other people, they're civilians. We always hear about civilians in Israel being injured or killed, and we're horrified by that, as I am. But I am also horrified when it happens on the other side. And in the Jewish newspapers here, I continue to read about how Palestinians are killing Jewish civilians. Well, you know, this horror has been going both ways for a very long time. And thousands of Palestinian civilians, children, fathers, mothers, they also have been killed. Following what happened in Jabalia last night, when I got back to the home I was staying in with my friends, you know, we sat down and we were talking, and I fell asleep. And then at about 1 o'clock, the F-16 started going around and around the Gaza. At 2 o'clock, Apache helicopters and warships were shooting and bombing all around us in Gaza. And it lasted from approximately 2 in the morning until about 6:30 this morning. And of those 15 that you mentioned that were murdered, that were killed yesterday, Palestinians, four of them were soldiers who were in a bunker on the beach here. And it was frightening. I mean, I'm living in a house where there's three little children, and they were terrified. And I'm sure every home was terrified last night. And so it's been quite a 24 hours here.
What has been the explanation of the Israeli military?
The explanation is that this is retaliation for the killings in one of the settlements that took place this past weekend. And interestingly enough, the people that were killed were not part of the organization that took responsibility for those killings in the settlement in Gaza.
And what about Israeli peace activists? What is their response, and how much outreach is going to Palestinians?
I met with several of the Palestinian peace camp people before I came down here, and there were close to 15 15,000 people in the streets of Tel Aviv, demonstrating for peace and an end to the occupation. When I asked the Palestinians in Gaza about this, they said, this is good, and it's good that the internationals are coming and standing and witnessing and all the rest of it. But many of them say, it's much too late. Others say, we've seen this before. After all, about 8 years ago, there were 250,000 Israelis in the streets of Tel Aviv demonstrating against what was happening in Lebanon and saying to the Israeli government, bring our children home, end this war in Lebanon. So they're afraid that this is just building a little bit more, and then when something happens, the peace movement will fall apart. The people in Israel, the people from Bat Shalom that I work with and know very well, their sense is that it's frustrating, it's difficult. They understand their limitations, but they feel that they're building the peace movement. When I asked today, I met with one of the heads of Hamas here in Gaza, Dr. Ramtizi. He's a pediatrician. And I asked him, I said, you know, what do you think about all of this? And he said, it's good, it's good. He said, but his belief was that the Israelis, the peace movement people who come and go, you know, it's lukewarm, they're nowhere to be found, and then they come out and they're there for a while and they build and they're strong and then they go away again. He said, and his point of view was that it is in fact the armed military actions that the Palestinians are taking that are pushing the Israelis to become active and working for an end to the occupation.
Barbara Lubin, eyewitness to the killings in the Jabalia refugee camp when Israeli military bombed the refugee camp in Gaza. You are listening to Democracy Now!
And I guess nobody who's never actually faced one of those policemen can know exactly how much bravery it takes to be just this gay and cheerful in the face of all kinds of things. A friend of mine telephoned me about 3 weeks ago, it was, the day after we read in our newspapers up here about what was going on in Birmingham with the dogs. And he said, Pete, you'd have to see it to believe it. They have a little dance down there. He says, I don't even know the name. I found since it's called the Wobble. But he says they do a song with it. You see, they start with a twist and then a step back and a step forward and a hesitation somewhere. He says, but they all sing, I ain't scared of your jail, cause I want my freedom, I want my freedom, I want my freedom. I ain't scared of your jail, cause I want my freedom, I want my freedom now. He says, you have to see it, though, to see how it works. There's Reverend King, he's giving them a lecture in church. He says, now this is to be a silent demonstration today. No songs, no slogans. And if any obscenities are shouted at you from the sideline, you don't reply to them. You keep right along the line of march. Until you're arrested, then the singing can begin. So they all file out of church just as solemn as deacons and as quiet as mice. Down the street go maybe a couple hundred of them, maybe. Along comes a policeman, he says, you're all under arrest. I ain't scared of your jail, cause I want my freedom. I want my freedom, I want my freedom. I ain't scared of your jail, cause I want my freedom. I want my freedom now.
I ain't scared of your jail. Pete Seeger in the live recording. Complete Carnegie Hall concert, June 8th, 1963. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The intense air war that supposedly targeted the Taliban and still seeks to disable or kill its top leaders has left a string of, well, at best you could say, mistakes across southern Afghanistan. Even the U.S. media is beginning to look into why Afghans have been forced to live and die with U.S. mistakes during the war on Afghanistan. The Washington Post has made visits to five villages near Kandahar over the last week, yielded testimony of about more than 100 civilian victims of U.S. airstrikes, corroborated by local commanders, Afghan officials, and firsthand inspection of the bomb damage. The reporters have found in a succession of villages, precision guidance munitions from U.S. aircraft sometimes hit precisely the wrong targets as pilots and their allies on the ground try to distinguish between fleeing or hiding targets and vulnerable civilians. These accounts indicate that while being very cautious about hunting Taliban or Al-Qaeda members on the ground, U.S. forces struck potential targets from the air with less discriminating firepower. U.S. bombs hit fleeing Taliban convoys, destroyed hidden weapons depots, and chased targets who hid in civilian areas. But airstrikes also killed children in their homes, pulverized trucks regardless of their cargo, and pounded a Muslim shrine into rubble. We're going to return to one of the few public voices expressing concern not only about the U.S.-led war on so-called terrorism, which has justified the aggressive military killings in Afghanistan, but also who looks at the war at home. Cornel West has come under fire at Harvard University, where he's professor of African-American studies and philosophy of religion. At a private meeting in October with the new Harvard president, Lawrence Summers, Summers, who, by the way, is formerly an IMF official and Treasury Secretary under Clinton, West says he was criticized for working on Bill Bradley's campaign and for some of his less scholarly work, including his recent hip-hop CD, Sketches of My Culture. The Harvard president suggested West embark on a new work of serious scholarship befitting his elite designation at Harvard as one of only 14 university professors. Lawrence Summers was recently quoted as saying that the university has to be more patriotic. Well, here is the second part of a speech by activist, theologian, and scholar Cornel West that he gave several months ago in the Bay Area of California during the presentation of the Mario Savio Awards. We now go to professor, activist, Cornel West.
It was terrifying before September 11th. We had a crisis before September 11th. All you had to do is look at the children. Look at the working people's wages. Look at the prison industrial complex. Look at the drug war, which was a war against poor youth, disproportionately black and brown. Already had a crisis, but it's now multi-layered. It's now multi-layered. Because in such a moment, paranoia and hysteria becomes hegemonic and pervasive. People begin to look for alternatives, and oftentimes they'll grab at straws, see. And so it mustering the courage to think critically and tell the truth in the spirit of compassion to fellow citizens. We have to shake them, because so many of us are asleep on our feet and need to be pricked like a stingray that bites, gets folks to try to think differently. You see, one of the ways we do that is to first try to connect ourselves with the best of the history. You see, because with the Socratic and the prophetic note is that precious democratic note. And democracies are so rare in human history, they tend not to last too long. And levels of paranoia undermine the very conditions for the possibility of democracy. And freedom is presented, people often escape from freedom, as Eric Fromm says. They'd rather defer to authority. So Dostoevsky's the Grand Inquisitor, Brother Karamazov. To be a progressive is to be against the thick forms of conformity, complacency, compliance, and cowardice. All four. And it is to believe, as radical Democrats, democratic socialists, feminists, womanists, anti-homophobic freedom fighters, whatever you call yourself, I would just say you're a decent human being, but we got all these labels. But whatever you call yourself concerned with these issues, it means, one, you have to bear witness in terms of the kind of person you want to be. Yeah. Regardless of what you think are the short-term effects and consequences. If we say, I am an Arab American today because they are being targeted. I am a Muslim American today because they are being targeted. Yes, you might not be popular. Who cares? We're not in this for a popularity contest. That's the kind of life we want to live. That's the kind of person we want to be. That's the kind of way we want to go out if we got to go out. That's the kind of trace we want to leave, the kind of legacy we want to leave. I hear black folks in a recent poll, the group most likely to support racial profiling, the Arab brothers and sisters. Now, it's hard for me to believe that poll because I got a bias, but I said, damn, all the hell we didn't come. And I guess it's partly understandable. You say, yeah, let somebody else have it for a while and get a little relief. But it lacks ethical substance. Now, of course, we can go back to our Arab brothers and sisters and say, it's not like you've been crazy about us for the last 10 years. Right. Kind of keep a little distance from the Negro.
That's right.
And now you need us and everybody else. And I'm saying you got some black folk who are going to be with you anyway, even given what your history is. Because it's right and moral and just. But it's not just about persons, as real as it is. It's the immediate targets. Thousands and thousands of folk in detention right now, since September 11th, just like Mumia Abu-Jamal, in detention for almost 17 years. Targeted by the repressive apparatus of the U.S. nation state. Vicious repressive apparatus in the name of security for some. You see, cleaning things up for some. No, to be a Democrat is to say, as that genius from this part of the world, Sly Stone, put it, everyday people have a depth, a geniality, a bigness of heart, mind, and soul that is potential and could be actualized if their voices are heard at the highest levels of the decision-making processes in those institutions that guide and regulate their lives. There's no accident that the Negro National Anthem is lift every
voice.
It's no accident that the greatest democratic art form to come out of not just only this country, but any other country in the world, which is jazz, is all about finding your voice. That Janie Crawford in their eyes were watching God is trying to find her voice. John Coltrane couldn't imitate Johnny Hodges for too long because he had to find his voice. It's all about finding your voice, and when you find your voice, you have a courage that just speak, to reflect about what you're speaking about and be willing to live and die for what you're highlighting in your speech that focuses on the plight of everyday people. Because everybody's a star, as I say. As Muhammad Ali put it, ain't nobody like me, ain't nobody gonna be like me. That's democratic individuality. That's not bourgeois individualism. Each one of us unique, distinctive, irreducible. No one like us, everyone unusual. And there's an extraordinariness in ordinary folk. There's a miraculous in the quotidian, as Ralph Waldo Emerson put it. That's a democratic sensibility. And if you don't believe it, then you don't believe really in democracy. It's just a little fig leaf to hide and conceal your oligarchic economy and your white supremacists and male supremacists and homophobic practices. You're not really a Democrat. Small D. You can't understand the workers' movement. How could you be a Democrat when their voices are not heard in the workplace? What a challenge. Now, it could be the case that American civilization really doesn't have the capacity to be a full-fledged democracy. That's a real possibility. The greatest text ever written on this civilization, Lexis de Tocqueville in 1835 and 1840, volume 1 and 2,
He came here and said, this is a fascinating place, a lot of democratic sensibilities, but there's something here that's deeply American, but not democratic at all. That last chapter, the biggest chapter in the text, in the first volume. He says, this place does not have the capacity to be a multiracial democracy.
Overlooked.
They might not even have capacity to be a classless democracy. It's a capitalist democracy with white privilege. And they might include some exceptional black and brown and yellow and red folk. But democracy is not about just making place for the bourgeois elements of these various peoples of color. If you can't deal with their cousins on the corner, then you haven't met the challenge. When Marcus Garvey raised the most terrifying question ever raised in America, he said, deep down, the vast majority of white fellow citizens will act KKK-like when it comes to political, economic, and sexual competition. They talk a good game. These chocolate folk move to the cities and white flight takes place. Move to the schools and new schools show up. Don't really want to embrace. You say Mr. Garvey is a harsh conclusion, but it's certainly an inescapable challenge. And progressives must take seriously Garvey's question. He said, as long as black people are outside of Africa, their lives will be lives of ruin and disaster. You say, Mr. Garvey, when's the last time you looked at Africa? Legacies of European colonialism, decrepit African bourgeois leadership, lies of disaster, ruin. And the words of Henry Holland Garnett echoed down through the corridors of time, never confused the plight of people of African descent with those of the Israelite in the Old Testament. For black folk, pharaohs on both sides of the bloody Red Sea. Nowhere to run, nowhere to hide. Somebody sing a song. Maybe the freedom will be in how we relate to one another to reform and revolutionize the very white supremacist America that has so utterly denied us and others. What am I saying? I'm saying in part. You are very patient. I'm saying in part. You cannot talk about being a progressive in American civilization and being a Democrat, radical Democrat, small d, without putting the struggle against the vicious legacy of white supremacy at or near the center of your program. You can't do it. Other issues are crucial. Ecological abuse, crucial. Wealth inequality, fundamental. But the litmus test, the Achilles heel, is this legacy of white supremacy, because if you deal with that legacy, then you'll be forced to raise the other kinds of questions, because when it comes to where so much of the ecological abuse is taking place, when it comes to the vast majority of these peoples of color who are working and underemployed and unemployed, when it comes to decrepit schools and unavailable childcare and inadequate health care, if you're dealing with the legacy of white supremacy, you're gonna have to deal with these other issues in a serious way.
Yeah.
But if you're dealing with these issues and somehow sidestepping that legacy of white supremacy, then we end up still so distant, separated by that veil that the great Du Bois talked about in 1903. And how do we do this? How do we forge ahead? Well, as you all know, I've been spending a lot of time with old brother Al Sharpton, part of the exploratory committee. People say, oh, Brother West, why are you spending time with him? My God, he's still wearing his hair like James Brown. Come on. I
I say, I don't idealize or idolize anybody. I'm a Christian, you see. I know everybody, who they are. But the question is, what kind of voice can make an intervention at the national level in terms of linking the vicious legacy of white supremacy and how we wrestle with it to the issues of wealth inequality, corporate power here and around the world, to the issues of ecological abuse? And Brother Al Sharpton, in dialogue with Brother Ralph Nader, and we brought them together the day before the election in the House of Justice on 125th Street and 5th Avenue. And it was a fascinating coming together. And once you get the forces of Brother Sharpton with the forces of Ralph Nader, they may not be able to party hardy together all the time, but they got some issues that they can wrestle with that will at least allow the nation to have to come to terms with an alternative vision, a radical democratic vision. On every front, on every front. Telling the truth about the Middle East. How do we deal with that delicate situation? Jewish brothers and sisters, Israelis, both Israeli Arabs and Israeli Jews, preoccupied with the possibility of national death, hostile nations, many of them still at war with the state of Israel, against the backdrop of European Holocaust. Not just 6 million precious Jewish brothers and sisters, but communists and socialists, gays and lesbians, all of them put to death like they cockroaches. And yet at the same time, the May 1948, war after war after war, Palestinian brothers and sisters, many of them already there,
yeah,
before the state was formed. How are you going to deal with this very delicate conflict? We have to be truthful about this in such a way. But even if we disagree, we know we disagree on principle. It's not a matter of being anti-Palestinian or anti-Jewish. You can criticize the state of Israel in a vigorous way and not be anti-Semitic. Yeah. If it's principle, only if it's principle. And you can tell the truth about the PLO without being viewed as some kind of anti-Arab, anti-Palestinian brother and sister. You have to be able to tell the truth. No one has a fundamental solution, but it's very clear that the alliance with the American Empire and the bias of that empire vis-a-vis the state of Israel,
colonialism,
in which babies and young folk on the West Bank can be slaughtered, but no press conference at the White House.
White supremacy.
But one Israeli soldier is treated in an inhumane and ugly way, unjustifiably, yes, but one Israeli soldier mistreated, press conference that next morning. What's going on here? We want justice. No revenge, we want justice. We tell our Jewish brothers and sisters that we stand in the tradition of Amos, and Abraham Joshua Heschel, and Sheldon Wolin of this institution many years ago, my dear friend and brother, a whole host of other Jewish prophetic folk who were willing to tell the truth about their own situation and the community from whence they come based on a universal democratic vision. And if Jewish brothers and sisters can aspire to that standard,
than each and every one of us in our respective communities will tell the truth about our own anti-democratic, non-democratic, quasi-democratic, crypto-democratic elements as well, right across the board, freeing each other up. Because in the end, that's what it's about. And I want to end. Earth, Wind, and Fire say sing a song. I got four notes in this song that I'm trying to sing tonight. Socratic note, prophetic note, democratic note. But I want to end on a blue note. That's what I love about the blues. Johnny Lee Hooker and Muddy Waters and Bessie Smith. Is that it's neither sentimental nor cynical. It is ideal for tough times. Says, I've been down so long that down don't worry me no more. That's why I'm going to keep on keeping on anyhow. That's the blues. Curtis Mayfield say, keep on pushing against the grain. Muster the courage to think. Muster the courage to love. Muster the courage to dissent and dialogue. Muster the courage to hope. That's the blues. The nation has the blues. Black folk had it for 400 years. How do you keep on moving? No optimism at all. Anybody who's optimistic 10 years ago, 50 years ago, today is out of touch with reality. We're talking about hope. Hope is not the same thing as optimism. Any progressive understands that you have to have something that is not spectatory, it's participatory. It's not distance from the funk, it's in the funk. And in the midst of the funk, as George Clinton would put it, you then start stirring things up. You start reaching out. You start energizing and galvanizing and regenerating and reinvigorating each other because you're accenting the best of each and every one of us, even given our imperfections. That's the blues. And yes, the hip-hop generation understands part of this. Because for so long, they've had levels of the blues that American society has overlooked. No doubt about that. And so in many ways, I'm speaking even more to the younger brothers and sisters of all colors here than I am to those of us who are starting to turn a little gray. You know what I mean? No more than just a little bit, just a little bit, just a little bit, brother. Still looking good with your brim on, but just a little bit. Because it's going to be that third wave of the hip-hop generation that have to transcend this market-driven hedonism and materialism and narcissism, hungry and thirsty for something bigger than them. Don't fall for narrow patriotic pits, but link yourself to a story bigger than you, a grand democratic story that goes back to John Brown and goes back to Sojourner Truth, that goes back to Ida B. Wells Barnett, that goes back to Miles Horton, that goes back to Brother Mario Savial, that goes back to Cesar Chavez and Russell Means and Mario Rukaiza. Yeah, so who in the world is she? Read the sisters. Freedom fighter, Jewish sister. They're part of the story. And you can't be a progressive with the blues without a story. And that's why nearly every blues has a story in it. Because the story generates movement and motion. And movement and motion means that, in fact, there's always some way of sustaining yourself against the grain, not just by yourself, but organized, affiliated, linked to some institution, and keeping the focus on working people and the poor. Does America have what it takes to meet this challenge? Open question. It does not look good at the moment. But if you have a blues sensibility, it has never looked good. Never. I've been a black man in America for 48 years, and I can rest assure you I have not had an optimistic moment in my life in terms of the capacity of America to meet the challenge for racial justice, class justice, gender justice, sexual orientational justice, but I still can stay full of fire because I'm a blues man. And I'm admonishing each and every one of you to become blues-like in your sensibilities, so you can both tell a truth, join with others, and be willing to throw down for something bigger than you. And I simply say to you, for those who are willing to meet the challenge, I'll be there with you, because I'm going down fighting like Muhammad Ali, swinging like Sarah Vaughan, and still with a smile on my face. Thank you all so very much.
You've been listening to Cornel West, scholar and activist of Harvard University, giving a speech in November in Modesto, California, at the Mario Savio Human Rights Awards. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
War? To kill war, you have to kill weapons. To kill war, you have to kill defense budgets. To kill war, you have to kill poverty. To kill war, you have to kill fear. A dead war has no military force. A dead war has no armed conflict. A dead war has no commitment to low-intensity combat. A dead war cannot launch a surprise attack. A dead war cannot oppose global peace. A dead war cannot invade other spaces. To kill war, you have to kill weapons. To kill war, you have to kill defense budgets. To kill war, you have to kill poverty. To kill war, you have to kill fear. To kill war, to kill war, to kill war, to kill war.
War Devoted to War, Jane Cortez and the Fire Spitters here on Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Standing beside South Korean President Kim Dae-jung, President Bush announced that he's no intentions of invading North Korea and that his goal in the region is peace. His remarks come as protests rock the South Korean capital of Seoul, and anger continues to simmer over Bush's now infamous axis of evil remarks. In a State of the Union address last month, Bush labeled North Korea the third spoke in a dangerous axis of evil that also includes Iran and Iraq. The comments sparked outrage in all three countries and led the North Korean government to accuse Bush of declaring war on the region. The United States' longtime ally, South Korea, did not altogether disagree. The government, as well as the citizens, have repeatedly called on Bush to withdraw or at least temper his remarks. But if Bush's visit to South Korea, which was meant to quell anger in the region, it is unclear whether he succeeded. On a trip up to the demilitarized zone, Bush called the North Korean regime despotic and insisted the burden is on the government of Pyongyang to prove it does not plan to threaten its neighbors with weapons of mass destruction. Meanwhile, down in Seoul, security remains tight as protests continue outside major U.S. facilities, including the American Embassy, the American Chamber of Commerce, U.S. firms, and military installations. Though the protests have been among the biggest in the country's recent history, the Western media has scarcely mentioned them. We turn first to Rupert Cornwell, who is a reporter for the London Independent. He's based in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi.
It's very good to have you with us. Can you talk about the Pentagon preparing for a covert campaign to win public opinion, especially in the Islamic world?
Well, it's not very covert if it's been spread all over the American papers, to be quite honest. But I'm not particularly surprised by this. This is classic standard operating procedure for major powers fighting a war or who believe they're fighting a war. The British have done it a lot in the past. The Russians, of course, are the absolute past masters of it. You remember the KGB and Desinformatia and all of that. The only thing is, I wonder whether it'll actually work, because it is, now that the news of it is out, people will treat everything that comes out of Washington with probably even greater skepticism than they do now. So I wonder whether, in fact, some kind of own goal has not been scored.
Can you talk about this axis of evil comment of Bush, as well as the reaction to it?
Well, the problem is that obviously these words were very well chosen. This wasn't just an off-the-cuff remark. You don't do that in State of the Union speeches. And there is clearly a logic in this, because if the terrorists do get in hold of weapons of mass destruction, then something far, far worse than September the 11th is going to happen. There is no doubt, too, that the three countries named in this so-called axis of evil, Iran, Iraq, and North Korea, are pursuing programs of weapons of mass destruction. The crux is, are they, in fact, promoting these weapons of mass destruction or pushing them in the direction of terrorist organizations, and that is completely unproved. That is my first doubt about it. The second one, which many people in Europe share, and I think rightly, is that how on earth can you lump these three countries together? They all have very different problems. Iran and Iraq, so much for an axis of evil, are sworn enemies, and they fought a war of nearly a decade long, not very long ago. Iran is a country which does have a reformist element in its leadership. That reformist element has now made clear that after President Bush's remarks, any chance of dialogue and rapprochement with the U.S., forget about it. So again, in the case of Iraq, I think probably President Bush may well have achieved more harm than good.
We also have Tim Shorrock on the line, who is a reporter who's been writing about Korea for decades. You wrote a piece last week. It was prophetic, Tim. President George Bush is likely to encounter the largest anti-American demonstrations of his presidency when he visits South Korea next week. Well, next week is now, and he has. You write that from the highest level of President Kim Dae-jung's government to the lowest paid industrial workers in the street, there's anger and consternation at Bush's threats to use military force to change the behavior of North Korea. But you say virtually unnoticed in the media is the role played by Bush's own father in trying to ease tensions with North Korea over the past year. Can you talk about that?
Well, it's interesting that Bush is rejecting the advice of not only his father, but many diplomats and former statesmen involved in Korea who speak about Korea from a very conservative standpoint. He seems to be listening only to hardliners in his administration right now and just taking the word of the Pentagon and the CIA. His father, as people have read, is a senior advisor to a major bank in Washington called the Carlyle Group, which invests in private companies. And George Bush Sr. is the chairman of their Asian advisory group, which gives them advice on where to invest in Asia. And South Korea happens to be the site of their largest single investments. They bought a major bank there 2 years ago, and they own a large telecommunication manufacturing facility, and they're just about to buy South Korea's largest tire exporter. And a year ago, Bush Sr., whose national security advisor was a man named Donald Gregg, who served as the CIA station chief in Seoul during the 1970s, sent a letter to his son urging dialogue with North Korea and urging a softer line toward the North. This happened about several months after Bush dissed President Kim Dae-jung in the meeting at the White House, where in front of Kim and on international television said he didn't trust the North Koreans enough to negotiate with them, deeply embarrassing Kim Dae-jung and basically stabbing a knife in the back of Kim's sunshine policy and setting back the reconciliation process in Korea. And George Bush Sr., for whatever reason, I'm sure that the safety of American investment in South Korea was a big part of his reason for telling his son to cool it on North Korea, nevertheless sent this letter to his son. The letter was actually a memo from this man, Donald Gregg, who has been very outspoken in terms of urging that the United States not be hostile toward North Korea and engage in dialogue and continue the negotiations that the Clinton administration was engaged in up to the almost the very last day of the Clinton administration, which were, by the way, aimed at ending the North Korean missile program, which President Bush now says is a great danger to humankind and so on. So we have, you know, so in other words, he gave advice to his son. His son, for a while, said, you know, okay, we'll talk to North, but then added many conditions that the North has found unacceptable. It's very unclear what his policy is now.
What about the level of starvation in Korea, North Korea?
It's very high, although the food situation there has improved considerably from what I read from reports in the World Food Program and other people involved, United Nations groups and private food agencies that go there, it's getting better. There is a serious problem. They've had some their economy has been in virtual free fall for the last 20 years. And many people have had a combination of, you know, economic collapse and also some serious droughts that's made it very difficult, and they're a very, very poor country. I can't give you precise figures, but from what I understand, the situation has improved considerably over the last year or so.
We're also joined on the line, in addition to Tim Shorrock, who has written about Korea for years, and Rupert Cornwell of the London Independent, by Reverend Kiel Chung, General Secretary of Korea Truth Commission on U.S. military massacres of civilians. You're affiliated group with groups that helped organize the protests. Who has been in the streets in Seoul?
I should say everybody. We've never seen in South Korean history like this time more than 700 students, civic, civil, national, local, regional, national movement groups, the nationwide, women's group, everybody in the streets, even before Bush's the 19th and 20th visit to Seoul. It's been huge, ongoing, nationwide, anti-U.S., anti-Bush, anti-war struggle we have never seen in South Korea.
And again, the different people who are involved, the different groups.
Very much so. Yes, actually, during the Bush's staying in Seoul, a man about 30, mid-30s, through a, the 30 stop across of the U.S. Embassy wall, and he was arrested immediately by the Korean, the riot police at the spot. You have never seen the person who is not part of the so-called the nationalistic, the progressive movement. This person is coming from internet friend circle, challenging U.S. war policy and particularly U.S. military occupation in South Korea, committing crimes against South Korean civilians last 50 years. This symbolically shows how different this time U.S. anti-U.S. anti-war struggle from the past. It is really, literally, everybody in Korea coming out to protest U.S. The State of the Union the speech, so-called the axis of evil. The U.S. media, such as the NPR, it's usual, but I was angry again. It doesn't tell the truth as a whole. Tim briefly mentioned about the North Korean, the poverty and hunger. The U.S. media doesn't talk about the U.S. economic sanctions against North Korea for almost 50 years. And how come on earth this small nation can survive? And how come this country can become a rich nation while the superpower with its military might for 50 years, the ongoing aggressive military policy right there in Seoul, the 38th parallel, how come we expect this country can become feeding their own people? So, again, we see since the June 15, 2000, historic North-South Declaration and huge nationwide the talk and the economic exchange, human exchange, reunification, reconciliation, development went on, the creating enormous hope and, future development. This whole thing has been stopped, has been retreating since Bush is in the power, bringing this the demonization of North Korean leadership, the country, and bringing the fear of war. And this whole thing, that Bush is going to talk about the Boeing built the F-15 fighters. It's about $4 billion worth of fighters trying to sell to South Korean government. And that this is part of the big deal the Korean people is fighting. And next year, 2003, the October, is going to be the year the 1994 agreed frame of Geneva Agreement is going to complete. The Biden U.S. is obligated to deliver 2 light water nuclear reactor, and U.S. is trying to hold upper hand in postponing this, the meeting of U.S. obligation. And we also see people in Korea challenging the reason why the Bush is bringing North Korea a part of this, his war, the so-called anti-terrorism war, is to justify his the military budget more than $396 billion. And the U.S. needs, some other country they can blame for, so they need to increase their military budget while cutting the money for human needs in this country.
Reverend Kiel Chung, General Secretary of Korea Truth Commission. I want to end with Rupert Cornwell of the London Independent and get back to this issue of the Pentagon developing a major covert news and disinformation campaign to help Washington win the propaganda war against so-called terrorism and the piece that you most recently wrote.
Yes. I mean, I think it's one of the, I think it's just counterproductive because it will reduce credibility of the official things that do come out of Washington. And really, this sort of thing is best left to the Secret Services, to the unmentionable parts of the State Department, or in the case of Britain, the Foreign Office, which do this kind of thing on a clandestine basis. It is completely unannounced. There's nothing formal. It's not known about theoretically at all. And thus, there is complete deniability. In this case, now that the cover has been blown, I feel that it's just not going to work very well. And I would be very surprised, in fact, if it goes through in the form that it's been mooted, because it's worth remembering that it hasn't actually yet been approved formally, this, even though people seem to be quite keen on the idea.
I don't think a lot of people really understand it. This Office of Strategic Influence, recently created, as you write, unit funded from an extra $10 billion of emergency funds voted by Congress to the Pentagon after September 11th, placing false news items in newspapers?
Oh, all that sort of thing, yes. There's nothing new about that. That's been done before. As I say, the Russians, the Soviets were the past masters in this sort of thing, and they tried to peddle campaigns suggesting that the U.S., for example, had developed AIDS as a form of biological warfare. They, in Korea, back in the 1950s, they were trying to say that the Americans were using germ warfare. These sort of ideas, this sort of strategy and tactics, is as old as modern mass communications. But as I say, I would be very surprised if it goes through in the form that it has actually been mooted now, given the fact that the cover has been blown.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. In addition to Reverend Chung, we've been speaking with Rupert Cornwell of the London Independent and Tim Shorrock, a reporter who's covered Korea for decades. That does it for the program. Democracy Now!'s website is www.democracynow.org. Our email address is mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner, Jeremy Scahill, and Chris Abrams. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. We're broadcasting from downtown Community Television. For Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition.
Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on.
On our way, we know the journey is slow.
Gotta hang tough through good times and bad.